Hey, it's Christine with Storyworthy. Today on the show, I celebrate my 11-year anniversary with four stories from fabulous comedians, like Margot Lightman talking about finding the perfect match.
And I told him about my scheme with the tickets. And so he goes, yeah, I'll go in on that with you. And then after we do that, do you want to sneak into a second movie? And I thought, yeah, let's do it. And so we did it and we got away with it. So naturally we got married because it was just the perfect match for me.
And comedian Veer Das shares a story about the handshake that changed his life.
We do Rishi Kapoor's close-up and I legitimately mess up my lines because I'm just watching the man act. You know what I mean? Yeah. Where you're not concentrating on what you're supposed to do. You're just going, oh my God, that's fucking Rishi Kapoor. And then after that, it's my close-up. And I didn't know that they wouldn't be there for my close-up. And I'm sitting there going, well, then who am I going to act with? And I have this full existential crisis going, what? This is Bollywood? Is this going to be me alone with like the third assistant director and like half a camera? Fuck this. I don't want to be in the movies at all.
And comedian Erica Rhodes talks about her first big feature film.
I knew my big break was just around the corner. I could feel it. I was 20, brimming with optimism, ambition, and the perfect amount of naivety. And then, finally it came. I had an audition to play a quirky robot named Clix for a sci-fi feature film. And after about 3 callbacks, I got the call. The part was mine.
And finally, comedian Theo Vaughn tells the story about killing squirrels with his father.
We started throwing these Kit Kats out to the squirrel, right? And then in the distance, another squirrel was hopping over, dude. And I don't know how this first squirrel knew about the second squirrel because I just can't imagine how he knew. Because, I mean, he had to be 100 yards away. By the time we left, we had 22 squirrels in front of us that we counted, all eating Kit Kats. It was just a huge community of animals just eating little Kit Kats and just enjoying them.
Today on the show, you'll hear 4 of the funniest stories I've ever heard over the last 11 years from Margot Lightman, Veer Das, Erica Rhodes, and Theo Vaughn. Stay close.
Hey, it's Margot Lightman. Happy 11-year anniversary, Storyworthy.
Mwah. Hey, this is Veer Das, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Hey, it's Erica Rhodes. Happy 11-year anniversary, Storyworthy.
I'm Theo Vaughn, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show of 11 years, or you're a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Today on the show, I'm sharing with you 4 stories that I found particularly funny that I've heard over the last 11 years, and I have a feeling you guys are going to agree. Now, I've recently changed networks to Podcast One. You can always listen at podcastone.com or, of course, wherever you listen to your podcasts. I always appreciate you guys for listening to Storyworthy. And head over to storyworthypodcast.com and join my mailing list. Would you do that? That would be fun. And then we can correspond. Do you know what I mean? So that would, you know, it works. So let's do that. All right, you guys, this first story was told to me from writer and comedian Margot Lightman in October of 2014. The story is called Finding My Perfect Match, and it's about how she met her husband. And this story has stuck out to me over the years as just one of the funniest things I've ever heard. Margot is so talented. She's written a couple of books, including What's Your Story and Long Story Short, and you can find out more about both of those at margotlightman.com. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for the very fabulous Margot Lightman.
So I used to live in New York City before I lived here in LA, and I lived there for 11 years. And towards the end of my stay there in New York City, I kind of got priced out of the city. And I was finding ways to scheme so I could afford to live there, ways I could cut corners. And I had this awakening one time when I was at the movie theater, and I went to buy tickets from the machine. And I pushed the button. I accidentally pushed the senior citizen discount button. And the tickets were normally at the time like $13 to see a movie, and they were only $9 at the senior citizen rate. And I thought, you know what? I'm not going to return these. I'm just going to go in and see what happens. So I go in, and nobody noticed or seemed to care. And so, and I was probably like 28 and nobody noticed. So I thought, well, this is what I'm going to do every time now because nobody cares. And I did. And I kept doing it. And then eventually I met this guy and I told him, and we started dating, and I told him about my scheme with the tickets. And so he goes, yeah, I'll go in on that with you. And then after we do that, do you want to sneak into a second movie? And I thought, yeah, let's do it. And so we did it and we got away with it. So naturally we got married because it was just the perfect match for me. And so we get married and we just keep doing this scheme of going, paying senior citizens rate and going to second movies and also sometimes popping our own popcorn and bringing it in. And so one time we go into the movies and we see two movies, and but what happened is there was this movie theater on the Upper West Side where we lived that had a upstairs and a downstairs, and downstairs nobody was paying attention, and often the ticket ripper was the popcorn popper. And so when we walk in, the ticket ripper was popping popcorn, and so she wasn't paying attention, so she just said go right in. So we go see one movie and then a second movie, and we leave with unripped tickets, and I have this awakening like, hey, do you think we could come back another day with these unripped tickets? So my husband and I come up with this whole monologue that I'm going to say when we get into theater. So we go back the next night and I say, I'm so sorry we came last night with my parents who are senior citizens and they at the last minute canceled after we had bought them these tickets. And so now I have these tickets and I'm wondering, can we use these to see another movie? And the manager said, yes. So then we went into a second movie, which was the remake of Friday the 13th. And then we went into a fourth movie, which is this horribly wonderful movie called Orphan. And I'll tell you about that in a second. But my point is, we saw four movies for this one $9 ticket. And it was just one of the greatest 48-hour sprees I've ever had in New York City in my life. Mm-hmm. So we see the second movie called Orphan. And I have to just summarize what this movie was about, because if you haven't seen it, you should really see it. But it was just a riveting tale. And it stars that lady, I don't know how to say her name. It's like Vera Famiglia and Peter Sarsgaard. So it has like a good cast. You'd think it'd be a great movie. And it starts, and Vera Famiglia, she is a mother who's a recovering alcoholic. And it's very tragic because the reason she had to get sober is many, many years ago, she accidentally drowned her child in the frozen lake behind the house in a drunken stupor. And so this has been a really tragic thing. Their family's really sad. And so years later, she's sober and she wants to adopt another child, but no one will let her adopt a baby because she drowned her first one in the lake. So they go and they're trying to adopt an older child from an orphanage. And they go to this, like, nun orphanage place, and there's all these older children, maybe, like, first or second grade, and they kind of take a shine to this girl, Esther, but yet there's something very strange about Esther. And so they adopt her, and there's a lot of red flags about Esther. Like, first of all, when they adopt her, she's wearing that velvet ribbon around her neck at all times, which is just you can't adopt a kid with that velvet ribbon. I mean, every movie, that is a telltale that something is wrong. So she's got this velvet ribbon, and then Esther starts acting very, very strange. Like they also have another child that didn't die in the lake, and that child is deaf. And she's like pushing around the deaf child, and then she keeps drawing these violent fires in buildings as her art projects, and then she keeps pushing everybody around that she knows. And the weird thing is she's trying to fuck the husband, okay? And she keeps trying to do this. And so slowly it unfolds that Esther, the orphan, is not really a 7-year-old girl at all. No, she is this 32-year-old woman that has this bizarre disease that makes her look like a child, but she's a child in a woman's body, but she's actually 32 and she just doesn't age. So she's a grown woman, actually, which explains why she's trying to have sex with the husband, because she's 32 and she has needs. And then everything starts to make sense. So at the end of the movie, she's this evil 32-year-old in a child's body that the Vera Famiglia ends up drowning Esther the orphan on purpose in the end of the movie in the lake. And we all want her to drown this kid. And it is really a perfect ending to a perfect movie. And my husband and I enjoyed it more than any of the 75 other movies we'd snuck into in our marriage. And we're having a great time. And then this is right around our first wedding anniversary. And we go see this movie. And I don't want to brag, but what we were doing for our first wedding anniversary was we were going on a Carnival cruise to Canada. And so we are boarding this cruise ship. And I have to say, I've been on a few cruises in my life. And what I want to say about a cruise ship is you have to let everything go. You can't judge people. You can't get on that cruise ship and start thinking like, oh, I look at these people and I understand how George W. Bush got elected twice. You can't have that thought. You can't look at everybody and go, this is how the obesity epidemic in America began. You can't. You have to go into the cruise ship. You got to let it all go. You have to hit the chocolate buffet. You have to enter the belly flop contest, and you have to have a good time. Let it go. So I let it go, and I get on the cruise ship, and my husband and I get on, and we eat a great meal, we have a few drinks, we have sex, we go down a water slide. The boat hadn't even taken off, okay? So then everything's going great, and it's getting time to go to dinner, and at dinner you go. The problem with cruise ships is the dinner time that you have to sit with at this table that you're assigned, which is like people they think you'll get along with. And so my husband hands me this pot cookie right before we go to sit down at this dinner with these strangers on a carnival cruise ship. They're sort of taking this cruise unironically. And so we go and we sit down, and there's two other couples there, and we're waiting for the fourth couple. We're making small talk, and this one couple is talking to us about the husband just keeps comparing everything that comes out to his favorite restaurant, the Outback Steakhouse, and he just keeps saying, you know, this is a good appetizer, but have you had the appetizers at Outback? And they're being really serious about this. And then the other couple next to me, we call the Ted Bundy couple, like the husband's really preppy, and he's wearing this like jacket with those things on the elbows, and like he looks like a serial killer. And his wife just like keeps applying red lipstick and like pushing food away and talking about how she doesn't want to eat too many calories. And so I'm sitting with these people, and finally the fourth couple arrives, and it's a guy and his girlfriend. But she's not just a girlfriend. She's like, she's his girlfriend, but I'm just going to be honest. She has the orphan disease. Okay. Like she is a girl in a woman's body wearing like a small size, child sized dress, but she has the face of a woman, and she's sitting there and she has the actual orphan disease. And I look across from my husband, and right in this moment, the pot cookie kicks in, and I'm like, oh no. And my husband taps me on the shoulder, and he says to me, hey, Margo, refresh my memory, what's the last movie we saw in the theaters? I just said, we are not doing this right now. Because I forgot to mention that after the movie, I researched orphan and found out that it was a real disease. There is a real disease that you can look like a child, but not ever grow into it. I mean, it's different than like the Webster thing. It's like you really, really look like a child, but you age. Okay, so this is a real thing, and it's really rare. So I'm sitting there, and now I'm stoned on this pot cookie, and the orphan is across from me, and I can't. I'm a very tolerant person, but I can't handle it. And so I'm sitting there, and the boyfriend is normal, and he's talking to all of us, but then orphan will only communicate by whispering in her boyfriend's ear, and then he'll speak for her. So everything's very insane. And then meanwhile, this guy's kind of deter everything by talking about the Outback Steakhouse, and it's very bizarre, the whole situation. So the waiter comes over to take our order for the entrees, and the boyfriend of Orphan, he goes, yeah, I'll have the steak. And then you hear, I like could hear Orphan whisper in his ear, and she goes, broccoli, and it's like horrifying, okay? And so I just can't handle it, and it's getting crazier and crazier, and I'm trying to make conversation with the other couple, and the Ted Bundy couple, she just keeps pushing food away and giving me diet tips, and the Outback guy just keeps comparing everything to Outback. And the next thing I know, the maitre d' of the cruise ship restaurant comes over. He's this really happy-go-lucky guy. And he puts his hands on the boyfriend of Orphan's shoulder. And he goes, and he's standing behind her. He goes, is everybody having a good time tonight? And we all go, yes, yes. And he's behind the orphan guy, and he goes, oh, sir, I see you brought your daughter. And then Orphan turned around and looked him right in the eye. And then the maitre d' goes, okay. He just backs off and walks away in this like crazy backwards walk. And my husband and I excused ourselves. Like we couldn't keep it together. And we excused ourselves, and we left, and we laughed so hard. And then we went to the front desk, and we asked if there's any way we could get our table changed, because we couldn't do like four more meals with Orphan. We wouldn't be able to keep it together. And so we go to the desk, and we say that we have to switch tables to just, if there's possible, just a solo table, and we made up the excuse that we had religious differences. We're schemers. What can you say? And then the next night we sat alone at a table, and we toasted to our 1-year anniversary with the alcohol alcohol we had smuggled into the cruise ship in Listerine bottles.
Okay, was that Orphan story funny or what? If you haven't seen Orphan, rent it. Would you do that? Because I'm telling you, it's too funny. It's like the worst movie you've ever seen, and you love it. All right, you guys, this next story is from comedian Veer Das, and he told me this story in May of 2019. The title of the story is The Handshake That Changed My Life, and boy, it's just a great story, and Veer is just a fabulous guy. I remember when he came to record with me, he had like this beautiful town car and a chauffeur, and he's hilarious. He is an actor and a musician. He has sold over 1.5 million tickets for his comedy act over 7 continents in 36 countries. He's India's highest selling stand-up comedian. And I got to tell you, Veer is just, he's just too funny. He's appeared on Conan and he made his television debut here in America with Whiskey Cavalier and Fresh Off the Boat. You can find out a lot more about Veer Das over at his website, veerdas.in. Veerdas.in. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for the very talented Veer Das.
Okay, so this is my story about the handshake that changed my life. We go back to, God, what is it? It is 2006. And I'm a comedian in Mumbai, and I'm doing pretty well. I have like a gig a week, and I do 5 minutes of comedy every week on CNBC, which is news comedy. And I haven't thought about acting at all, even though I went to drama school. But, you know, it's Bollywood, and I'm 5'8", and I'm decent looking, but everybody in Bollywood is just goddamn beautiful. Yeah. And so it's not something that I'm actively thinking about at all. And a director named Vipul comes to one of my shows and he's like, hey kid, you're interesting, do you want to get into the movies? And I'm thinking, this is like every, hey kid, you want to be in the movies, you know, like it's just as typical as that. And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll do a movie. I've never acted for screen before, and I'm thinking he's gonna give me like this amazing part, right? It'll be like one of those 40s films where all of a sudden I'll be starring in something. It's one scene, 3 lines in a movie. Right, so I get flown to Hyderabad, and it was one of those scenes that wasn't really important to the movie, you know, where they hadn't written my lines until I got there. And that's how you know you're not really part of the movie. Now, what a lot of you don't realize is that, you know, to you, a movie is like a hero and a heroine and a villain and a camera, right? But there are hundreds of other people in a movie. Right, and there's nobody who's more committed than the guy with one line in the movie, right? Because that's all he gets. To him, that's his shot, right? He thinks he's going to do that line and the earth will fucking open up and the producer's going to be like, I found my next, you know, big guy for my Terminator franchise or whatever, etc., etc. And which is why he usually does that line in the worst possible fashion and overacts the hell out of that line. So I'm handed my lines at 6 o'clock in the morning. I've been on an all-night flight to Hyderabad. And we are sitting on a terrace in Hyderabad. And if you don't know Hyderabad, this is June. It's ridiculously hot. And the scene is that I'm a prospective groom for this beautiful Indian actress called Katrina Kaif, who's this A-list actress, who had just kind of started making Bollywood movies at that moment in time. And she had just come down from London and didn't really speak Hindi that well, but she was getting into Hindi movies and she was learning Hindi. And her father was this guy called Rishi Kapoor. Rishi Kapoor was a big hero in the 70s and the 60s and in the 80s as well. And now has kind of graduated to playing the father in 2004 or 5. And is having this great second innings where he's definitively becoming like India's Robert De Niro. You know, he's that big. And I'm a big fan of the guy. That's the only reason I said yes to this, is I want to be in the same frame as Rishi Kapoor. And we're sitting on this terrace in Hyderabad. I have 3 lines in this scene. And Rishi Kapoor and Katrina Kaif walk in. She's one of the most beautiful women you'll ever meet in your life. And somebody holds an umbrella over Katrina Kaif. And somebody's holding an umbrella over Rishi Kapoor, because big stars need to be protected from the sun. I'm umbrella-less on this terrace in Hyderabad, just baking in the sun. And this other junior artist, who, and that's what we call extras. We call ourselves junior artists, which is kind of patronizing, but sure. This other extra who plays my mother, both of us is baking in the sun, changing complexion shades as we go. And I don't know anything about acting in movies. So to me, I've done theater, right? So I don't know that you'll put a camera on one person and it'll be their close-up, and then you'll wait 35 minutes and then you'll put a camera on me and it'll be my close-up, and then you wait another 35 minutes and then the camera will go far away and it's another 35 minutes. I think the only reason that actors and actresses sleep with each other is just boredom to pass the time because making a film takes that long. I also didn't know about dubbing. Which is that sometimes when you don't deliver a line right, or when you're not a first-time speaker of the language, you can mouth the lines and you can dub them in later. Mm-hmm. So I don't know this about making movies as well. So we're sitting in it and the director's like, shall we rehearse? And Rishi Kapoor's like, no, I have my lines. Come on, let's just go. Let's just shoot. And we're shooting a master shot, which means the camera is far away. And all four of us are on camera. I think it goes... I say something, then Rishi Kapoor says, that's a really, really good idea. And then it goes to Katrina, and Katrina kind of goes, I like this guy, Dad. And it's in Hindi, so she goes, Papa, ye ladka mujhe bahut pasand hai, iska idea bahut acha hai. Which is, I like this guy, and I think his idea is pretty good. That's the line, right? And so we're in the sun, and director yells action. And I do my line with all the conviction and overacting in the world. And Rishi Kapoor does his line, and it goes pretty, pretty well. And then Katrina Kaif just looks at me and goes, Papa Lash, flash, 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 and kind of mouths the lines. And she was going to dub them later because she was just learning the language. And I'm just sitting there looking at her going, am I high? Because that's not Hindi and that's not English. And I don't speak Dothraki yet because Game of Thrones hasn't come out. But I don't want to fuck up because I'm in the middle of this scene and the scene just keeps going. And then the director yells, cut. And I'm like, okay, clearly there's been a mistake and somebody's going to say something. He's like, guys, that was fabulous. We're going to do another one. So I'm like, okay, clearly something is wrong. So we just do this again and again and again in the sun where it's like, I say my line and Rishi Kapoor's like, that's a really good idea. And Papa Lish, flash, 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 flash. And later when you watch the movie, she's dubbed the Hindi in like a dubbing studio and it sounds fantastic. And on the spot. But you just see this look of me collapsing and nervousness on my face. And, you know, I notice that every time they cut, somebody puts an umbrella over it. She could put an umbrella over this thing. Now, I started out looking Indian. I look African by the end of this scene, right? Because I've just burned that much in the sun. And we do Rishi Kapoor's close-up. And I legitimately mess up my lines because I'm just watching the man act. You know what I mean? Yeah. Where you're not concentrating on what you're supposed to do. Yeah. You're just going, oh my God, that's fucking Rishi Kapoor. You know, and I mess up my lines. And then with Katrina's line, I'm just looking at her going, please God, let me, I've had too much sun. Let this be intelligible to point in time. But I'm also fascinated because she's doing a really good job.
Yeah.
You know, even though she doesn't speak the language yet, she's emoting and I can't imagine how hard that must be. And then after that, it's my close-up, right? So, like, my mother doesn't even get a close-up, by the way, because she's got no lines in this scene. And I didn't know that they wouldn't be there for my close-up. Right? So just before my close-up, Rishi Kapoor gets up to leave. And Katrina Kaif gets up to leave. And I'm sitting there going, well, then who am I going to act with? And I have this full existential crisis going, what? This is Bollywood? No, is this going to be me alone with like the third assistant director and like half a camera? Fuck this. I don't want to be in the movies at all. And as they're getting up to leave, Rishi Kapoor suddenly grabs my hand and he says, son, what is your name? And I swear to God, I forgot my name. So I'm just sitting there and you know, I'm a pretty cool guy. I tell myself I'm not going to be like starstruck or anything. The minute he grabbed my hand, I lost. I was just like, hee, 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 hee. You know, like I just felt like an actress in the 70s. You know what I mean? Where and I felt like I joined this club of actresses in the 70s whose hand he had held enchantingly. And I just couldn't for the life of me remember my name. So he goes, son, what is your name? And I go, what? Oh, and he goes, I asked you your name. And at this point in my mind, I'm going, what the fuck is my name? What is my name? What is my name? What is my name? And again, I go, excuse me? And he goes, I'm asking you your name. And the thing is, he's making direct eye contact with me and he's still holding my hand. Like he hasn't let go of my arm yet. And to kind of reinforce what he's saying, he doesn't just grab my hand. He slides further up and grabs my arm and gives me a little shake because he's a reasonably macho man. He's like, what is your name? And I said, sir, my name is Veer Das. I managed to get that out. And he says, Veer Das, are you nervous? And I think he was asking me that just to kind of fuck with me. So I got a little defensive and I'm like, yeah, you know what? I am nervous. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, that's good. You're a really good actor. So you must shake my hand right now and you must promise me that you will keep acting. Now, here's the thing. Rishi Kapoor is at this point in his life, maybe 59, 60, I don't know. He's probably made 300 movies. There's no reason for him to do this. You know, and I recognize that. Like he's, like I said, a movie is 100 people who have one line. So if Rishi Kapoor has made 300 movies, that's what, 30,000 people like me that he has interacted with over the last 30 or 40 years. There's no reason for him to do this. I refuse to believe that this is something that he just does with 30,000 people, right? So I kind of laughed it off. He's like, no, I'm not kidding. He's like, you shake my hand right now and you look me in the eye and you tell me that you will keep acting. And I go, yeah, I will keep acting. And I'd never even thought about it. You know what I mean? I'd done drama school and I'd rebelled against drama school by doing stand-up comedy. You know, that was kind of my, after 3 years of Shakespeare and Chekhov and Miller and Simon, just kind of going, fuck you, I'm going to do this organic art form, which is stand-up. And just brought me back to it. You know, so, and then it's kind of providence, but he shook my hand and said, promise me you'd keep acting. And I said, I promise I'll keep acting. And the minute he left, I'm not even kidding, in under 10 seconds, somebody put an umbrella over my head.
Oh, my God.
Right? And it's almost like that's what I needed. Like, I needed that seal of approval from Rishi Kapoor and Bollywood to get an umbrella put over my head. Now, 3 years ago, I made a movie. It didn't do very well, but, you know, c'est la vie. I made a movie where I played the hero of the movie and Rishi Kapoor played my father. And that was 10 years after this happened. And I was on a flight with him and I said, you know, I wouldn't have done it. Like I was happy. I was content. I wouldn't have done it had you not done that. And he says, you know, I've done that 5-6 times in my life. And it always works out for the kid that I do it to. So yeah, one handshake changed my life.
Is that a great story or what? I mean, he had his moment. I mean, he met his idol. I think that's so fabulous. And I'm so glad that Rishi Kapoor was cool, right? I mean, what if he had been, I don't know. He died recently. Do you know that? It's true. Rishi Kapoor died about 2 years ago. Anyway, thank you, Veer Das. You cracked me up. I hope you're back in America soon. Okay. All right, you guys, this next story is from comedian Erica Rhodes. It's called My First Big Feature Film, and she told it to me in October of 2014. Erica is an accomplished comedian and also an actress. You've seen her on ABC's Modern Family, HBO's Veep, Fox's New Girl, and IFC's Comedy Bang Bang. She headlines comedy clubs all over the country, and not only that, she's a really nice girl. Find out more about her at ericarhodescomedy.com. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Erica Rhodes.
Okay, so I was 20 years old and had recently dropped out of Boston University to follow my dreams, I mean my boyfriend, to New York City. And after being cast in my first off Broadway play, I realized this is it. Acting is what I'm meant to be doing. The stars have aligned. The universe is telling me what to do. So I jumped in head first. I started taking an acting class. I got my first headshots and started taking auditions for pretty much anything I got called in for. And I knew my big break was just around the corner. I could feel it. I was 20, brimming with optimism, ambition, and the perfect amount of naivety. And then, finally it came. I had an audition to play a quirky robot named Clix for a sci-fi feature film. And after about 3 callbacks, I got the call. The part was mine. I was elated. This was like the first paid role in a major feature film. I called my parents and everyone else I knew to deliver the great news, and they were all very proud. I was on cloud 9. A few weeks later, I had my wardrobe fitting. Apparently part of being in acting class was occasionally going out and partying. And I didn't do it frequently, but this particular night I had, and this particular morning, I woke up very hungover and groggy on some actor model bartender's couch, and I was almost late for my big fitting, so I freaked out, grabbed my clothes, ran downstairs, hailed a taxi, and arrived to my fitting just in time, no doubt reeking of vodka. My costume was a tiny, tiny, microscopic gold sequence dress. I picked it up and said, "This is it?" And thigh-high gold boots. I tried it on, and they assured me it looked amazing. They then handed me a contract. Still hungover, I glanced at the 10-page packet, and I said, "My mom's a lawyer. She'd kill me if I didn't read this, but I can trust you, right?" The wardrobe lady kind of nodded, and I signed, took off my barely there dress, and I went home to sleep off my hangover. 2 weeks later, and I was off to Connecticut to shoot my first big movie. There were 5 others in the cast, 3 from L.A., and 3 of us local hires from New York City. When we arrived on set, the first moment was a bit of a shock. An actor named Chris was being whisked away in an ambulance. They yelled for us to stay back as we watched him being carried off the set in a stretcher. It was very disconcerting, but I wasn't going to let this get me down. Besides, the producer assured us he was fine. It was just like a minor malfunction with the set or something. We were then introduced to our director, a zany guy who wore purple nail polish. We all gathered around for our first table read, which we did on speakerphone for the Japanese investors of the movie. The director was fluent in Japanese and translated the script as we went along. The Japanese financier seemed very impressed, and Greg, our director, seemed very relieved. The other actors were really nice, all guys except one girl, Allison, who said that she got the part because she was in the waiting room during her boyfriend Sherrod's audition, and Greg saw her and gave her the part without even so much as an audition. True Hollywood story, I thought. Whoa. Though I did notice that she and her boyfriend didn't seem to be getting along and kept fighting in front of everyone, which didn't seem appropriate. Well, my suspicions climaxed when that night the producer suggested we all have rehearsal in the hotel room over pizza and beer. We were all reading and having a good time when I swore I heard what I thought was moaning next door. I suggested we look at the room guide, like we had a list of the rooms and where everyone was sleeping, to see whose room it was. And sure enough, it was Allison's room. I announced, "She's having sex." Then after an awkward 10 minutes or so passed, we got a knock on the door, and it was our director in a robe asking how our reading was going and also informing us the script might change a bit because he wants to give Allison some more lines. I mean, it was unbelievable. I was experiencing firsthand what it really was like to work in movies, and I wasn't sure I liked it. All I could think was, wow. The big time is really corrupt and weird. The next morning, Chris, the injured actor, was back on set, his arm in a sling, but looking okay besides that. He explained that there was a malfunction with the special effects or something, but he was fine now. I had to arrive very early because my wardrobe consisted of being fully body sprayed, head to toe, in gold body paint, which was about a 2-hour process. But the makeup girls were really fun and friendly, so I didn't mind. I even gossiped a bit about the last night soap opera and told them everything. This was also my big day because it was Clix's huge monologue, which I had been up all night learning. I still remember the monologue. This is how it goes. I am frightened, overtly discombobulated. 7 swans a-swimming, 6 geese a-laying, 5 golden eggs, 4 score and 7 years ago, must recalibrate my tertiary deployment syntheticloids with contextual ionic neo-exportation replicators. Well, right before I walked on set, I saw a huge fire spark, and the director started yelling at the special effects guy, Jeremy, accusing him of being intoxicated. He was so mad, he even asked me if I thought Jeremy was intoxicated. And I said, I don't know, I'm not sure. Oh, also, right before this, Chris actually got injured again. So now he was donning an arm sling and an eye patch. So clearly the tech guy was not exactly cut out for his job. The director ended up firing him on the spot before my scene. And we continued like nothing happened, and I did my monologue and nailed it, and everyone applauded, and I felt like this is a moment I have been waiting for all along. I'm a star. I was then interviewed for a Japanese TV show which had confetti and crazy games. It was fun, though. She asked me about my character and other things I don't remember now, and I even had to do a taste test where I closed my eyes and guessed what I was tasting. I got it wrong, and that's when the confetti came down on my head. But after that, things were really kind of falling apart all around me. Allison and her boyfriend, Sherrod, were clearly battling it out as he knew about her affair with the director. And Chris somehow got injured again and was on crutches. And the two guy actors had to share a costume because they were playing Siamese twins. So they had to go to the bathroom together and do everything together because it was too hard to get in and out of the costume every time. So they were going crazy and like fighting nonstop, and it was all just like this big mess when we had our final scene. Chris hadn't learned his lines, so we kept having to start and stop again, and you could tell the director was about to lose it. It was tense on set, but it was the last scene. We were almost there. Chris and Greg got into a small fight, and Chris almost got fired, but he begged for one last chance to get the scene right. He had all the lines, and all we had to say was, "Mukashi code!" Finally, he got a take that was somewhat acceptable. When we got to the end of the take, the producer came on set and said, "Congrats! You guys weren't starring in the film Mukashi Code. You're the stars of your own reality TV show." My heart sank. This whole thing had been a gag at our expense. Apparently, only 3 of us were the actors being duped. Allison and her boyfriend, and in fact, everyone on set, from the producers to the makeup artists, everyone was in on it except me and the 2 other New York actors. I was humiliated. I sobbed, and they turned the camera away from me. Here I thought this was my big break, and it was all a hoax, and I was just a big joke. I was so upset. They drove us home in a limo with champagne and paid us $1,000 as if that would ease a humiliation. I called my best friend and I said, "You know, at least the makeup girls were nice to me. Though they didn't tell me what was going on, at least they were nice." And being my best friend then and now, she said, "Well, that's all fine and good, but fuck them." And she was right. They all lied to me, and being so naive and full of hope, I wanted to believe it was real so bad that I ignored all the weird signs that it wasn't. Anyway, a year later, I booked a real indie feature, a horror film called Plague Town, also shooting in Connecticut. And I almost got fired from that because of my terrible paranoia that anytime there was a camera on me, I worried it was yet another reality TV show. Not sure what you call that disorder, real annoia. But I told the director, David Gregory, about my traumatic experience, and he totally sympathized, and that film was real. Not to say there wasn't behind-the-scenes drama. There definitely was, but at least it was real drama this time, not some kind of stage drama. And at least I was a real actress this time. But in some ways, you know, I don't regret being a little naive. Like, I think I'd always choose that over being jaded, because I feel like the world can hurt you more, but you also get to experience so much more that way. And eventually I do believe that it makes you a stronger person.
You know, when Erica first told me that story, I almost cried. I'm not kidding. It made me so angry. And I don't know if it's because, you know, I've personally been taken advantage of because I am naive, or I was naive, you know, or I don't know. But I got to tell you, she sure is showing them, because Erica is so talented and she is really going places. So thank you, Erica. That story is too funny. All right, you guys, this last story is from comedian Theo Vaughn. It's called Killing Squirrels with My Father, and Theo told me this in May of 2016. Theo, of course, is a comedian, and he's got a couple of podcasts. One is called This Past Weekend, and the other is called King and the Sting. And he is just an extremely funny guy. Theo's made appearances on Inside Amy Schumer, Why with Hannibal Buress, Arsenio, Last Comic Standing, and he was the winner of Comedy Central's Reality Bites Back. You can find more about Theo over at TheoVaughn.com. And wherever you are, you guys, put your hands together for the very funny Theo Vaughn.
When I was young, I was a child. I mean, most of us go through that. My dad was very old. My dad was 70 years old when I was born. My dad was born in 1910. And I remember when I was probably about 11 years old, and I was tall enough, my dad would let me drive for him. As long as I was tall enough, he would let me drive him. So I had, I'd hit a little growth spurt kind of early, and so my dad would let me drive him around. And I remember times where we would go to the post office and he couldn't, there was nowhere to park or nothing. So he would just say, "Well, just drive around the block a couple times and come pick me up." And I would go around the block and I would just like hit five or six cars going around the block. And my dad's car was a piece of shit. It was like a Delta 88. And it was all banged up and he couldn't tell if it was banged up or not just because he wasn't that good at looking at things and seeing them fully. So he didn't really know. So I come back around and just pick him up. My dad worked at colleges sometimes to make money. He was like one of those men, you know, now they have people in the airports that yell at you. It's usually black people that yell at you to come over and fill out credit card applications. Well, my dad was one of those people before those people were mostly black. And so he would go to college campuses and he would have, people come over and fill out credit card applications. And he always had some kind of like bait or ruse that these companies give you, like Chase or Visa or Citibank or something. They give you like a item, like a bait, you know, like come get this neon green duffel bag, you know what I'm saying? Or come get this, you know, like a double-sided frisbee, you know, or just some bullshit, you know, come get this, like a kettle or something, or just something, you know, like come get this tea kettle. You know, just some bullshit. So anyway, my dad would go up there and he would be at the college. He would yell for people to come over. And every application that we got filled out, my dad got $2. So that's how it worked for those people at that time. And my dad would take me and he would let me drive him. And then we'd drive maybe 70 miles to get to some of the colleges. So I'm sitting there 11, 12, maybe max, just driving, you know, and I'd be hitting 70, 80 miles an hour cruising, bro. I wasn't afraid to open it up. I wasn't afraid of speed even at such a young age. And so I'd open it up and get us over to the universities or whatever. Then we would get the people to come over to the tables and make the credit card applications. And so that was pretty cool, man. It was pretty fun. And my dad's car was a piece of shit, though. Like, it was a piece of shit on the outside, and then the inside was just like more of like a homelier type of piece of shit environment. Basically, he had stacked like any kind of things he'd ever had in his life was all in his car. It was wet down by the bottom. He had some speakers in the back because he brought the car off a brother somewhere in New Orleans. So, and one of the speakers had broken, and they had a thing of old Chinese food in it, so it rattled. And didn't even do no speaking, really. It just, one of them just basically just rattled with Chinese food. So anyway, that was kind of the car we were in. I had three brothers and sisters. I had a brother that was 2 years older than me and two sisters that are 2 and 4 years younger than me. And my parents got separated. So on the weekends, a lot of time, my dad would just take us and spend time with us. But he always had like things he had to do or something. And so sometimes he would just buy us like a bag of pies from the Burger King and he would take us over to the park and drop us off. And the crazy part was they had other kids at the park whose parents had dropped them off. So you'd just be at the park. And so sometimes we would just be out there eating pies all day and just living life really and just being children. And one time, the bait that they had given him for one of these credit card companies was a Kit Kat. Kit Kat candy. You know Kit Kat candy. It's like an orange kind of candy wrapper. You open the wrapper, they got candy in there. They ain't fooling anybody with their fucking game plan, right? They're honest. This is it. Kit Kat candy, right? So that was the bait. You get people to come over, you give them the Kit Kat, they do the applications. So my dad had a bunch of Kit Kats in his car and like cases, bro, like 4 or 5 cases. And they would heat up and get real hot and all fucking melt. And then they would cool out again and they would get cool. So he was always bringing them inside and out of the house because they'd have to cool off these Kit Kats. So when we was over there one time, we was running just literally, we were basically just doing slave labor. No offense if you're a slave. But we were doing like modern day child slave labor, dealing with a man who had maybe about 7 or 8 boxes of Kit Kats, and we were just running them in and out of the house to put them in the cooler. Well, so one time, that's just really the setup for the story. That's really just like the tertiary environment. So let me take you guys up to the front seat right now. So a lot of time my dad liked to rest because, you know, he was older, and older people like to rest because you know, just because eventually they're going to be resting for a while. So they figure they kind of get a little lead in on it. So my dad would go to the park sometimes with us and just be like, y'all clean out the car and then y'all go play, right? That's the rule. So we would try to clean out the car, man, but the car was fucking uncleanable, dude. They sometimes had animals down in there. They had roaches living in the car. The car was disgusting, dude. It was disgusting. We must have cleaned it 70 times, and it was disgusting before and after we cleaned it. The ceiling was always hanging down. It had like one of them ceilings, like a old lady's just skin. And so it was always just kind of hanging down onto your head. Well, so this one time we was over by there by the park, and my dad was resting. And he was resting. And he said, all right, y'all clean out the car and then crack you open a little case of Kit Kats because it was somebody's birthday. So we got a whole case to ourselves. Well, first we started and just sitting over by the car and just started throwing some Kit Kat out because we saw a squirrel. So a squirrel would come and get this Kit Kat. And squirrels, honestly, dude, they're kind of assholes, bro. I really refer to them kind of as like the Persians of the animal kingdom. You know, they'll like take shit from you, but then they act like you didn't even just fucking give it to them. You know, so that kind of pisses me off a little bit. But anyway, no offense if you use a Persian squirrel. And if you're offended by that at all and you're not a Persian squirrel, then you fucking suck. But onward. So what had happened was we started throwing these Kit Kats out to the squirrel, right? And then in the distance, another squirrel was hopping over, dude. And I don't know how this first squirrel knew about the second squirrel because I just can't imagine how he knew. Because, I mean, he had to be 100 yards away. So how do a squirrel know, unless maybe a bird went by, saw the one squirrel, and then maybe gave a sign to the second squirrel that was further away? I don't know how they would get that message over there. Yeah, something. Yeah, maybe that. Maybe that. So it could have been the squirrel sound. It could have been that. I can't do it as good as you can. So then what had happened was, so we start feeding the squirrels. So next thing you know, other squirrels hopping in the distance and other squirrels hopping. And we're cracking open these Kit Kats, man. We're cruising through them, bro. Cruising. I mean, we must have given out about 40 Kit Kats, probably. By the time we left, we had 22 squirrels in front of us that we counted, all eating Kit Kats. It was just a huge community of animals just eating little Kit Kats and just enjoying them. And catching a little bit of sunshine. So finally, you know, we got out of there and that was it. And that was the birthday party. And then about 3 days later, we're with my dad and they had an article in the newspaper that a bunch of squirrels had died because they didn't know why. And I don't know for sure that is what killed these squirrels, but I could not think of any other reason why those squirrels at that park, why they found 20 or something dead squirrels. I cannot imagine at all. But they ate just so many of them, and it just, you know, and I wanted to feel sorry for them, but they just seemed so, sometimes just so fucking Persian while they was eating them. And no offense if you're Persian.
Is that guy a character or what? I love that story, and it has definitely stuck with me over the last 11 years. All right, you guys, listen, thank you so much for listening to these last 4 stories. And once again, a big thank you to Margot Lightman, Veer Das, Erica Rhodes, and Theo Vaughn. And don't forget to check out more about Storyworthy over at podcastone.com, or, of course, you can find me at storyworthypodcast.com and follow me on Twitter at Storyworthy. All right, you guys, thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a Storyworthy week. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.